Fear and trepidation as some schools reopen today in this pandemic. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, some kids in this region of Florida are going back to class today, masks optional. And lots to talk about as we get into back-to-school issues in Florida. Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, what you can expect when visiting Mocha Jacksonville, which reopens to the public tomorrow. Plus, Art Republic's latest project. But first this hour, here is the latest on the COVID crisis by the numbers. Statewide, we are reporting 532,806 cases of COVID, 8,186 deaths across the state. The death toll climbed in our area over the weekend to 314. Meanwhile, schools around the state are starting to reopen today, including Baker County in our area. Now, in Baker, students are returning to class with masks optional. That's drawing widespread criticism already. At the same time, a new report finds Florida school districts were prevented by Governor Ron DeSantis' administration from seeking advice from their county health departments about how or even whether to reopen physical schools this month. Lots to discuss. We're pleased to welcome back to the show Emily Block, education reporter for the Florida Times Union. She's on the line. Hi, Emily. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. Good morning.
Good to have you. And here's our question to callers. Did you send a child back to school today? Are you worried about back to school later this month? What are your questions about how school districts are dealing with this? 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And our Facebook page is already getting your comments. Emily, in Baker County, kids went back today. On social media, there are a number of posts showing that they are not all masked, that masks are optional. In just the last 2 weeks of July, at least 97,000 children around the U.S. tested positive for coronavirus. And so we're learning about all this as we also found out the other day, as you report in the Times Union, that when the State Department of Education ordered schools to reopen, they told superintendents they had to be open 5 days a week, but at the same time, they suppressed county health directors' ability to advise school districts. And so lots of anxiety around the state. Let me first get your thoughts about the Baker County reopening with optional masks. That flies in the face of public health advice, correct?
Yes, correct. So that's something that we're starting to see in a few different counties, masks optional for both teachers and students. It's not what Duval County is doing. It's not what St. John's County is doing. It's obviously not what some of the larger school districts in South Florida that are more affected by the coronavirus, like Broward and West Palm and Miami, are doing. So it, you know, in the end, it is up to the school districts, but it certainly is not what the CDC is advising. And it will be interesting to say what happens, because this is a case study. This is an experiment. This is one of the first school districts in Florida to go back along with three others. So we're sitting and watching.
Right. Today would have been back to school in Duval County, for example, but the Duval County School Board pushed the date back to August 20th. So kids get a little more time on break. Now, let me ask you about this report. It originated in the Palm Beach Post, and you've done some more reporting in the Times Union. In Jacksonville, along with school districts around the state, the superintendent and the school board were stymied in their effort to get real guidance and direction from the Duval County Health Department. The DeSantis administration told health officials across Florida not to give school districts any guidance. Why on earth did they do that?
Right. So there's a catch-22 with this executive order. Earlier in July, the Department of Education Commissioner Richard Corcoran released an executive order saying that schools either have to open 5 days a week in person, or school districts can submit for a waiver in conjunction with their local Department of Health. The problem is that the Department of Health, we're told not to do that. We're told not to communicate, to collaborate by the Surgeon General. So it forces school district's hands to opening. And we were hearing that from a lot of school board members, those frustrations of how are we supposed to collaborate if we can't? It's basically pushing us all, pigeonholing us all into one direction of opening 5 days a week.
And this really has put superintendents and school boards in a difficult box. And so, for example, what we've seen in Duval County is they've tried a series of stopgap measures to hopefully slow the spread of the virus. The hybrid learning plan for older kids, which will commence on August 20th. Have you heard from any educators, administrators in Duval as to whether they could tweak this plan yet again if we start to see spiking cases in other school districts that begin to open this week? Could they go back to all virtual, for example?
It's possible. The communication that I've been getting from the school district is that things are fluid and they're rolling with the punches as they need to and pivoting. We're hearing that word a lot. Pivoting as they need to. So, for instance, this, like you said, schools were supposed to start this week in Duval County. They ended up delaying that. One of the questions should it all be virtual? The agreement was for it to not all be virtual, but there are still two virtual options. But schools will resume in person in a hybrid version starting August 20th. And that hybrid version is part of a plan that Duval Schools submitted that actually defies the executive order that I was referring to earlier. So it should be interesting to see how that will be adjusted along, you know, over time. One of the caveats in this plan is that as of after Labor Day, if they need to reassess, if things aren't going so well, that they'll do so. So that's the timeline they have right now.
It's 549-2937 to join us as we speak with Emily Block of the Florida Times Union. We want to hear from you up in Georgia, too, everyone. You know, Emily, some students up in Georgia posted on social media pictures of crowded school hallways, no masks or social distancing as class began up there. Some kids were suspended for posting these photos, but then the outcry was so great that the suspensions were rescinded. I think that shows you the anxiety that the kids are feeling about this, along with teachers who have complained loudly and have even sued over being forced back into the classroom. What's the latest on the lawsuit that has been filed by teachers in Florida protesting the back-to-school plan for the state?
We're still sitting and waiting again. I know a lot of teachers are kind of looking at that, seeing if it will change them having to go back into a classroom 5 days a week or going back into a classroom in some capacity. So there's a lot of people kind of on the edge of their seats right now and waiting to see how that will change things.
549-2937, do you have kids going back to school this month? What are your thoughts, questions about the planning? Are you a teacher, maybe? We want to hear from you, too. Give us a call. It's 549-2937 to join the show. Bill is in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. I've got two issues here. First is, if you kind of talked about it, it's the first you say you do, then we don't. First you say we will, and then we won't. You guys are calling
it anxiety. Isn't that a song?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I would like to hear from a neurological guy who says, okay, this kind of anxiety, how it does affect the true health issues, perhaps increasing the things. But the other thing that really is troublesome, is in 57, 58, when we had the Hong Kong Asian flu, we had more people die from that on a per capita basis. I think when it finally finished, we had the equivalent of 210,000 people die. And we went through these same kinds of school issues, yet I haven't heard one scintilla of how it was handled and how it worked out.
Yeah, you know, often people harken back to the 1918 pandemic, Bill, to try to draw some comparisons. And I appreciate your thoughts about this. Because, Emily, the pandemic of a century ago just had more parallels to what we're seeing today than the 1950s outbreak that Bill mentioned. It's my understanding anyway, because it was so widespread, so global, and there was such loss of life. What's your reaction to his comments?
I mean, it truly is, as you said, Melissa, fascinating to compare this to 1918. I was reading, there's a really good article in The Atlantic about it that talked about how there are so many parallels. I mean, masks were recommended. People didn't want to wear them. they were ultimately politicized the way they are now, even though health experts were saying this is actually going to protect you and going to protect the people around you from getting more sick. So it's fascinating and a little scary to see right. the similarities.
And as he pointed out too, the sort of back and forth on guidance or the lack of guidance is only increasing anxiety. Here is a comment on our Facebook page from a listener. Why have local health departments been muzzled? We have no reliable experts giving us guidance beyond political posturing. And as you report in the TU, Duval County is in the top 12 counties in the so-called yellow zone with the number of cases per week and the positive percentage rate. It is above the numbers that public health experts say is safe to send kids back to school.
Zone.
Yeah, excuse me, we're in the red zone. Pardon me, thank you for correcting me. Red zone guidance means, as you report, masks at all times, physical distance, limit social gatherings to 10 people or fewer. That is not a safe framework for sending kids back into the classroom. Because there will be more than 10 people in schools.
It directly defies federal recommendations. I mean, this is part of a federal report that the Trump administration's COVID-19 task force sent out. And that task force is saying that Jacksonville's in the red zone, Duval County is in the red zone. I believe Nassau County is in the red zone. This is in my reporting if you want to go back to it. And I also link to the actual federal documents. But yes, correct. And it says that social gatherings should be limited to 10 people or less, that a person's normal activity should be reduced to 25% of their regular activities, et cetera. So, and that mask should be enforced. So a lot of what we're seeing, especially like today in Baker County and so on, and even alluded to in Duval County school district's plan, it completely defies those recommendations.
Do you think the revelations about Governor DeSantis and his administration muzzling local health departments will give school districts more cover to back away from this directive from the state and even maybe defy it and just say, look, you know, you're not giving us good leadership here. We've got to think of the health and safety of our students and teachers first. We're just not going to go along with this. Does this give them cover to do that?
I certainly think it gives them posture to gather together and unite as different school districts, because again, this has affected every school district. We're seeing this across the state. But the catch there is that it's that like a go big or go home situation. Like either it's going to lend posture to a lawsuit, or a lot of school districts, if they're doing it individually, I know that they fear it hurting their funding.
And can you explain a little further about that? If districts openly defy the state and do not hold 5-day-a-week classes, how that will affect their funding?
Yes, for sure. So the executive order, again, it requires 5 days a week of in-person schooling. A lot of school districts, they worked on submitting waivers, including Duval County School District, but there's still that uncertainty of if we fly by night and do something completely radical and different, like Broward schools, for instance, going completely virtual. School districts that do not have the same reserves are worried that completely defying the executive order, doing what they want because legally they can do what they want, and just saying, like, we're not going to even consider this executive order, there's fear there that I'm hearing from multiple school districts and school board members that it could impact their funding because so much of this is ambiguous and that is up in the air. So they're worried that it could alter how the state of education allocates funding toward them.
It's 549-2937. Peter at the Beaches. Hi, Peter. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Yes. On that point right there, with the schools and the testing, why wouldn't you want to have the same exact testing for all government employees, the same regulations that we have for school teachers and students, for all local and state employees, requiring them to have, on premise or in the office working. If you declare that, maybe there'll be more of an outcry on the safety side.
Peter, thanks for that. Emily, what about that comparison Peter at the beaches is drawing?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great, a really great topic that we haven't touched on a lot yet is the testing. So Duval Schools last week announced with the Duval Teachers United, what they are saying is unprecedented, that the school district will cover any out-of-pocket health costs if a teacher or a family member on their health insurance contracts the virus, which is like comforting and also terrifying at the same time, right? Is what I'm hearing from a lot of teachers. Like, cool, thanks. If I get it, you'll help me with the cost to stay alive.
Awesome. We've even seen lawyers saying, if you need help, teachers, drawing up your will, I will do it for you for free.
Right, exactly. So
which is so morbid and gruesome to contemplate.
Absolutely. But to that point, and also I know that the teachers, when they were doing one of their marches, they marched through the cemetery and examples like that, that they're really trying to drive home that, like, we could die and we're scared for our lives. And I hear that from so many teachers. And, of course, I also hear the opposite. I hear, I miss my kids. I'm willing to risk it. I want to try it. We'll do it with the mask. We'll do it with the partition. So there's, you know, there's not a one-size-fits-all reaction or answer to this, which makes it complicated. But back to the testing, one of the parts of that health plan that Duval Schools and Duval Teachers United announced is that teachers will be given access to rapid testing, that they have the answer within 24 hours. So it brings back the question, if teachers are getting this, should students have that same availability to testing, and how is that going to impact the landscape of going back to school?
It's 549-2937 as we talk about back to school with Emily Block of the Florida Times Union. Some students in our area did go back to school today. More are going back in the following week or two. 549-2937 to join us. Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Good morning. I was wondering what will happen if a student doesn't wear a mask. I know they can send students home if they don't adhere to other parts of the dress code for the school. And yeah, so thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that. Emily, particularly with younger kids, I just can't even imagine how teachers are going to enforce the mask policy in Duval County. You would hope older students would be a little more conscientious, but I think to be realistic, we have to assume that some of them won't. And how do educators plan to enforce getting as many students as possible to follow this directive and mask up?
Right. Well, enforcement is the hard part here because masks are required, at least in the Duval Schools plan. They'll be required throughout the day, but they are not necessarily enforced, right? I mean, they made it very clear from the beginning of looking at the code of conduct, looking at the dress code policy and everything else that went into a mask requirement that they weren't going to, there would not be any sort of punishment entangled with if a student does not wear a mask. What I've seen so far in the policy, and again, this is changing all the time too, is that masks are required. They're required throughout the day. They're required through like anything that makes sense other than like eating lunch, obviously, or PE or band if you're like using a woodwind instrument or something of that nature, or brass, obviously. But they are, if a student does not have one, they will be supplied one, like a disposable surgical mask. And then from there, if they still refuse, that's the question. That's the ambiguous question. I do know that younger school levels are being required, are supplied with face shields instead. Because to your point, Melissa, how do you get a six-year-old to wear a mask all the time? It might not be feasible. So they're also using those plastic face shields and seeing if that makes a difference.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for clarifying that. You know, kids get sent home if they don't conform to dress code. Will they get sent home if they refuse to wear a mask?
That is unclear at the time, but it's something that everyone is very quick to point out, including students. I keep seeing, like, memes that are going around now among students and on Twitter saying, oh, well, you're not able to enforce masks, you say? Talk to me when I wear spaghetti straps to school. Or, you know, talk to me when my shoulders are showing and things like that. Which, again, speaks to a bigger problem of sexualizing kids for exposing their shoulders and things like that. And obviously there's so much history tied to how dress code policies are gendered and problematic in themselves. But, again, a bigger story.
Right. One we've talked about on this show, but just not today. Let's go to Jimmy in Jacksonville. Hi, Jimmy. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. have a quick question, kind of like a comment too. I'm just wondering why, if these government representatives know the correct information and they're distorting it or suppressing it and people end up dying because of that, why at some point wouldn't that be criminal that they're doing that?
Jimmy, thanks. There are already lawsuits against Florida leadership on this. And Emily, certainly Governor DeSantis has taken a lot of criticism for seeming to take his cues on education in this state from the president, who has insisted that schools reopen, even though, as you said, that flies in the face of his own government's health advice.
Right. So what we're seeing, and it's a pattern that we've pointed to before and that people are pointing out very quickly, is that the president tweeted that schools need to open, and then Betsy DeVos said that schools need to open, and then Governor DeSantis said schools need to open, and then Richard Corcoran, the education commissioner, said schools need to open, and then all of a sudden schools were needing to open. So it's not lost on anyone, reporters or teachers, very clearly. So it's something that we're seeing, and it does lend to the question of, well, is this actually what's best, or is this just a directive to appease the president?
Here is something else I want to ask you about. A teacher down in Volusia County actually had to launch a GoFundMe campaign to buy hand-washing stations in their classroom, because so many school districts around Florida don't even have soap. Adequate soap in classes and bathrooms. And so as we're all being told to hand wash constantly and wear masks and socially distance, my own daughters have told me this too, that most of the schools don't even have soap in the bathrooms most of the time. So how are kids to even wash their hands if there's no soap, and teachers in poor districts have to actually go to GoFundMe to try to get supplies to keep kids alive in class? It's simply
right.
Unbelievable.
It's absolutely. It's terrible. It's something we've seen tale as old as time, right? I mean, I remember being in high school and not having soap or the paper towel dispenser being empty. And, you know, that's something we see all the time. Both my parents are teachers, and they see it in their school district as well. Duval County says that's part of why the extension happened, right? They say that they've been ordering supplies since the beginning, but because there's such a desire for soap and sanitizing products and things of that nature, that there's a backlog. Even if you do everything right on your end, there could still be back orders and things like that. So they're saying that the delay in school starting, along with giving access to professional development, it gives the schools more time to prepare, right? They're saying that it's more time to outfit them with their partitions and to figure out the soap situation and to get their sanitizing products and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. And on Facebook,
so we'll see.
Yeah, on Facebook, Lisa asks, do all school buildings have everything in place according to the CDC in order for everyone to be safe? And the answer, as you've
right.
been saying, is basically no, right, Emily?
Right. They're working on it. They say, I mean, Duval Schools Superintendent Diana Green seems confident, probably apprehensively confident. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but she seems, I mean, at school board meeting, she seems pretty confident that schools will have what they need by the time school is reopening across Duval County, and that they've ordered massive doses of supplies, of PPE, not just for teachers, but for students and faculty. That they're bulking up on their sanitizing and everything else. They seem pretty confident that they will have what they need. I don't know if teachers feel that same level of confidence, though.
Right. Speaking of which, a teacher sends an email to the show asking about a resolution that was presented in July before the school board, asking that district staff be allowed to work from home. He says that that is being ignored or stifled, presumably due to the concerns you already outlaid about their funding being cut off by the state, by the governor and the Department of Education. So
it's tricky. That resolution, it did pass. It was a resolution, the very condensed version of it, is it's a resolution to allow teachers to work from home if they don't feel comfortable going into classrooms yet. Because originally, even if a teacher signed up to teach for Duval Homeroom, which is the virtual version of a student's school, they were still being required to go into the building, even if they were teaching a virtual class. So people were pointing out that that doesn't really make sense, that defeats the purpose. Now a resolution is passed to let those teachers, if they feel like they need to still work from home, work from home. The problem is that that hasn't been blatantly spelled out to teachers with what that exactly means. What I am hearing from school board members and, again, other sources is if you're in that position, that you should talk to your union is the advice that I've been hearing, because it varies person to person depending on the situation. If it's immunodeficiency or if there's extenuating circumstances, it all kind of depends what version of that resolution they're going to get and what version of support they're going to get. It depends. It's all very person to person, which, you know, raises a bigger issue with if teachers just don't want to go to school, why should they have to if they're allowed to work from home? But again, I digress, but that's a bigger issue that we don't see the answer to yet. On the micro level, it sounds like they would probably have to talk to their union.
Okay. Steward. Lots of tweets. Amy tweets the show, charter schools are exempt from the requirement to offer 5 days a week in person and they receive state money. How is this double standard fair? Sierra, it's difficult to work and homeschool my second grader, but that's what I'm going to do. Of course, parents with little kids at home are going to be right back in the soup as we send kids at least back to virtual school if that's what parents choose. Brian tweets us, will schools even make it to September? That's a very good question, Brian. I think there is a good chance things could shut down within a few weeks of opening if cases spike enough. Here's a tweet from May. What is the plan for when students test positive, warranting quarantine? Will it be just the student's class or the entire school? Do we know the answer to that, Emily?
Yes, it's dependent on the outbreak. So if they are isolated to a classroom, it might be a classroom-specific shutdown. If it's something more school-wide, then it could be a school-wide shutdown. It really depends. Duval Schools has outlined this in a matrix, is what they're calling it. I reference it in my most recent reporting about the Department of Health being suppressed in their answers to school districts, but we talk about how it really just depends. The catch there is that a lot of it deals with, even in that outline matrix by the school district, how they're coordinating with their local Department of Health, which we've heard until now has been basically non-existent. Now the school district is telling me that ever since the revelations have come to light that there was suppression, suddenly the Department of Health is talking to them again and working with them. But again, we don't totally know exactly what that looks like, and the plan very much relies on them to deem if a classroom needs to close completely, if they need to pivot to Duval homeroom, if a school should completely close. That depends on what the Surgeon General is saying. So there's a lot there.
Yeah, there certainly is. So many calls from Mandarin today, by the way. Anne is in Mandarin. Hi, Anne. Good morning.
Hi, Melissa. I was wondering, why doesn't the school district do a video at each level of school, K through 3, 4 through 6, 7 and 8, and then high school, and air those videos, put them on their website so that parents and students can look at that before school starts and say, okay, you know, a parent to a six-year-old, this is what your classroom's going to look like. This is how they're making sure that it's clean. You know, and if I even had a six-year-old, I would be telling him, you're going to wear a mask. And I would tell the teacher, you let me know if he doesn't. Mm-hmm. But that's me.
Yeah.
But high school kids, too, my son is 16. He doesn't know really what to expect.
That's right. I think
I thought that was a waste.
That's a really good idea, Anne. Thank you for that. And I would encourage everyone to go to DuvalSchools.org or wherever county you're in, go to your school district's website. Emily, there already are some videos up. Do you think they'll be continuing with that? Because they have really tried very hard to transmit information to families in real time.
Yeah. I was going to say the same thing, that DuvalSchools.org, they actually do have some videos. I know that when the desk partitions that separate student to student were approved, they had already put out a video to kind of give an idea of this, what it'll look like. They've put out videos of students like in a classroom wearing their face masks and face shields. So to Duval Schools' credit, I mean, they're trying to give that visual aid. I'm sure it's difficult because school isn't in session yet, but DuvalSchools.org does have a lot of those guides to kind of what they think it's going to look like. I do think part of that, the trickiness to all of that, though, is that they don't exactly know. I don't think anyone knows until it really happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. We're going to have to wait and see how this plays out. That said, what we've seen as the virus has had outbreaks around the nation is that it seems reasonable to assume that we're going to see spiking cases a few weeks after schools reopen, which could very well lead to them shutting down again and going all virtual again. That's not an unreasonable assumption, Emily, is it?
No, not at all. And I think Duval schools, school board members have pointed out the same thing and said, like, so it's not an if we shut down, it's when we shut down and how that will look, like classroom to classroom, when the classroom shuts down, what's that going to look like?
Right. And so in particular for students who will, we know from our experience in the spring, will not do well with virtual school. This is just crushing for those students and their families, whether it's a student with special needs, a student with ADHD. There are a number of students who really struggled with virtual learning. And so we are, as parents, and I'm one of them, our family, we're looking forward to more of the same, most likely, a really difficult time for many students trying to navigate this and a very difficult time for teachers trying to teach the best they can virtually. It's just been agonizing for so many families. And the thing that's so frustrating is that it did not have to be this way. If there had been a comprehensive national strategy for pandemic response from the beginning, we would not still be in this situation now. And that, I think, is what is so frustrating, Emily, for parents and teachers and administrators and students.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself, Melissa. It's just everyone so badly wants, you know, we're waiting for normalcy again. So many people want that, want to be able to just walk the halls with their friends, but a lot of national level problems happened. A lot of people dropped the ball that were so wide outside of the scope of this city or county that it's made it quite impossible. Now we just have to roll with punches that seem nonstop.
Here is an email from Andrea. I am a teacher at a local school. My children go to two different schools. If my class is quarantined, will my children also have to quarantine? Would their classes then have to quarantine? That shows you the complexities and the ripple effects that we could be soon facing, Emily.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really complicated. I know that Duval Schools has been working on their own nursing, like coronavirus committee, and they're working on hiring additional contract tracers through a CARES Act grant. And a lot of that position, a lot of the contract tracing is going to be doing exactly that. Well, how many kids do you have? What schools do they go to? What does this look like? And then coordinating from there to see if that means an additional classroom shutdown or if just that student has to quarantine and what that looks like.
Let's take one more call as we talk about back to school planning with Emily Block of the Florida Times Union. Rusty on the Northwest side. Hi, Rusty. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Several years ago, we had block scheduling in DCPS, Duval County schools. So it was A days and B days. Now, with the virus here, what's our method of transmission of the virus? It's aerial droplets, airborne droplets. We know that if we socially distance and spread them out, that's effective. So is it part of the plan to, as anyone suggested, go back to A days and B days where a teacher would see a student on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or the following week, see them on Tuesday, Thursday, and magically you cut the school population in half by having them come either on an A day or B day.
Right. Thanks, Rusty, for that. Emily, a sort of a version of that is what's currently being planned, isn't it?
Yes, kind of, sort of. So there are going to be alternating days depending on grade level and who the student is and the number of students that have enrolled. It varies. So there's never going to be a full school the way we would have seen last school year pre-pandemic. It's not totally what Rusty's suggesting. You know, it's not like an A-B schedule, but it's an A-B day that kind of falls into their schedule. And Duval Schools is also looking at cohorts, right? So they can't keep the same group completely together because their electives might vary, especially like in high school, but they're trying to keep the same core group together, and they still have to travel from classroom to classroom, again, because of electives and other intricacies. They can't just stay in the same room all day the way like an elementary school class would. But they're very much emphasizing cohorts in that they're going to have limited numbers alternating school days under the hybrid plan. Of course, that'll change in September depending on how things are going. If they're trending okay or everything's status quo, then it'll be everyone back 5 days a week that opts to go 5 days a week, minus the virtual students. But for now, we are kind of seeing a version of an A-B day. And those intricacies, like what that schedule will look like, depends on grade level, and that's available on the school district's website. I won't even try to condense that or explain it because it's hard to say out loud.
Right. Check out DuvalSchools.org or whichever county you reside in. Check out your school district's website because things will probably change. And read Emily in the Florida Times Union. Subscribe to the Times Union because they are doing amazing local reporting on this critical issue and many others. Emily, it's always good to have you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
And much more still ahead later in the hour. We'll tell you what visitors can expect when Mocha Jacksonville safely reopens to the public this week. But up next, how Art Republic is supporting Jacksonville's civil rights leaders through a series of powerful new murals. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm a reporter, and you've probably heard me on this station. When I'm putting together a story, sometimes it can start off feeling like kind of a mess. There are times when there's a lot of information to comb through, and it's also just really been a long day. But I have editors who might ask me to make another phone call or double-check a statistic. A lot goes into making sure our stories are fair and accurate. I'm Sky LeBron, and this is WJCT News 89.9.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. Every week on our show, we apply the tools of journalism to stories that are so small and personal, journalists normally would not cover them.
It was my forged signature, and it was my boyfriend's handwriting.
Or we look at stories that are big. Refugees, school segregation in America, the split in the Republican Party.
Climbing out from the smoking ruin and say, anybody else alive around here?
And find surprising personal stories there, too. This American Life.
Saturday afternoon at 1, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Art Republic Global has transformed downtown Jacksonville with a series of huge dynamic murals on public buildings across the urban core. Now they're focusing on this area's rich Black history, and civil rights luminaries from Northeast Florida to commission some powerful new works. I spoke about it with Art Republic founder and CEO Jessica Santiago. Hi, Jessica. Good to talk to you.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the Lift Every Voice Public Art Project.
So we are very excited about this one. This is our fifth edition of Art Republic. And what's special about this one is that this is really the culmination of all of our last 5 years of work, of what we've been really looking to do, the impact we've been wanting to make. And it is really focused on giving Jacksonville its authentic history and narrative, because what's interesting about Jacksonville is a lot of our, you don't see our buildings and streets and parks and artworks that reflect a lot of the greatest contributors of our cultural history. So this will be the first time that we have, in a really large scale, all of these large public installations that are telling these old narratives and showcasing the icons of our history.
So these will be new public murals, and they're just incredibly compelling, the ones that you've already put up on buildings around town. But 15 new murals in the urban core, and they'll tell the story of some of the leading civil rights figures of this community, like James Weldon Johnson, who wrote Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Black National Anthem, as it's known. Who else will you be celebrating with this project?
Mary McLeod Bethune, one of the great educators, Abraham Lincoln Lewis, Rutledge Pearson, who was an incredible civil rights activist. What's unique, too, is there's so many of the executives that were executives of the NAACP, educators, poets, musicians, both, you know, of course, the two Johnson brothers. And we're also going to honor a lot of the musicians that came through Jacksonville, that Jacksonville was near and dear to, and even the writers like Thora Neale Hurston and all of the different jazz musicians that were part of the Chitlin Circuit that came to Jacksonville, and the Jacksonville had a warm welcome to them when the South was so racially charged.
And what's the timetable for creating this art? When are we going to see it out and about?
So artists actually begin arriving on Sunday evening. So they'll spend the first couple days meeting with Ennis Davis and Malk Jacks, who are our creative directors. They have been so incredible. We actually spent since last November, Malcolm and I have been working on these narratives with Ennis, really getting the details of the history, the figures who should most first be honored, and all of the actual locations, trying to match the locations of where the murals will be going with the narrative. So that will, they'll be meeting with them for a couple days, and then we will be actually starting by about the 13th. So from the 13th to the 22nd, they'll be going up.
So pretty soon. This is exciting. And anyone who's driven around town and seen what you've done so far knows the incredible impact of these public murals. So we're really looking forward to see the next iteration of this. Jessica Santiago of Art Republic Global Online. Always good to hear your voice, and we look forward to seeing this new artwork.
Great. Thank you so much.
A quick break, and in a moment, speaking of art, another museum is opening this week. We'll speak with the leadership of MoCA Jacksonville in just a moment. Don't go away. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
I'm Tanya Mosley. Birth rates in the U.S. have been declining for some time now.
People are getting married later. Women are pursuing their careers. And we are feeling the economic pressures of trying to wait until couples feel that they have enough money.
And we look at how this pandemic might impact future birth rates. Next time on Here and Now.
Today at 2, on WJCT News 89.9.
The uncertain fate of TikTok in the U.S. has some users anxious. But for most, even those who make money on the platform, it's business as usual.
So back in October, I got fired from Best Buy for making TikTok videos. 2 weeks later, I hit 1 million followers. And now I'm still making videos, but
creating TikToks when there soon might not be a TikTok. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 here on WJCT News 89.9.
We're used to seeing Jesse Eisenberg on the big screen, but the actor's background is in writing for the theater. And without a physical stage to perform on, he's revisiting an old American favorite, audio drama. His new play paints a world that's full of complicated people, not heroes and villains. We talk to him about seeing In Shades of Grey next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. MoCA Jacksonville, a cultural institution of the University of North Florida, is reopening its doors to visitors tomorrow with two new exhibitions. Now, it will be a slightly different experience for visitors to MoCA, and we're getting an update now from Kathleen Doherty, director of the museum, and Ilva Rouse, senior curator. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. How are you?
Good to have you both on the show. Kathleen, let's begin with you. MoCA is reopening, but of course it's in the middle of a pandemic, so there will be some safety precautions. What can we expect?
There will be safety precautions. It's been a tough decision and a hard decision for MoCA, like many cultural orgs, to think about the best way forward. And we've taken a very cautious approach. Our top priority has been health and safety for staff and for visitors alike. That's been throughout. But following CDC guidelines, we've created what I think is going to be a safe experience for our guests and our staff, but also a very dynamic and in fact, quite innovative one, where guests will be able to come in person as an option, but also will be able to be on a virtual guided tour of the galleries, which we've developed, that they can come on from home. So
you'll
have two options,
an
in-person.
If one of you, I think, has the San Marco train going by. I just wanted to explain what that noise was. Go ahead, Kathleen.
No problem. We're open for registration. It's pre-booked tours. So do log on and get your spot. The public can sign up from today, August 10th. Online registration for all of our tours, both in person and virtual, can be found on our website, which is mocajacksonville.unf.edu, or on Eventbrite. The two options in person are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then we also have our socially distant wearing mask that will be for 10 people only, so you must get in and book your tickets early. And our virtual tours will be Tuesday through Thursday, 11, 1, and 3. So these are 90-minute tours. People will be able to enjoy them at their comfort level. The virtual tour is particularly exciting because we actually hired a videographer from here in Jacksonville with a company, a startup company, 360 View Virtual Tours. And Ryan Hickox of that company did a tremendous job and created 360-degree views, videos of our gallery.
Very nice.
So what that means is that our education team, our curators, can do live remote viewing of the gallery. So you literally can walk through the spaces for both visitors and folks like school tours. You know, I know as a parent that I am looking for ways that I can safely engage with arts and culture for my children.
Of course.
The idea of doing a trip virtually is something that's really exciting for many.
That's excellent. And Ilva, whether it's virtual or in person, MoCA is debuting two new exciting exhibitions this month. Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, we're so excited to open up our exhibitions to the community again. We have two brand new exhibitions for guests to enjoy. One is a beautiful art installation in our Project Atrium by artist Srina Banerjee. that explores the relationship of nature and culture through the old Indian myth of Sita. It's a very timely exhibition for what we are living through right now. And as part of our partnership with the University of North Florida, we have an exhibition curated by UNF Professor Sheila Goloborodko called Multiple Ones, Contemporary Perspectives in Print Media. And this exhibition shows how artists today are using printmaking methods in the most surprising way to create their art. It's a really fun show for all ages. And we've also extended exhibitions that were open prior to the closure. So our featured exhibition about Jackie Holmes, Breaking Boundaries, will now run until November. And that's a must-see for anyone interested in the history of the contemporary arts in our city.
Of course. So, again, people need to go to Mocha Jacksonville's website to register for both the in-person and live virtual tours. That goes live today. Mocha membership gives you priority access. And Kathleen, the cafe, the Mocha Cafe, which is much loved, is also back open with a grab-and-go menu. So that's exciting as well.
Hugely exciting. And the thing to remember with Mocha Cafe is that every dollar raised at Mocha Cafe goes directly to support the museum. That's a really crucial thing because if you're weighing up, you know, where will I get my grab-and-go or my takeaway or something to bring home to cook tonight or to reheat tonight, where will I grab that from? Every dollar you spend at the Mocha Cafe goes to help support our museum. And that's hugely important when you think about the challenging times we're in right now.
That's right. So grab some food at the cafe and check out the new exhibits at Mocha. Executive Director Kathleen Doherty and Senior Curator Ilva Rouse have done a lot of work on this. Great news, ladies. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having us this morning. Great to hear you.
Yes. You as well. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening, everyone. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a wonderful week. Keep wearing your masks, everybody. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.